Okay, Ghostbusters, Ghostbusters.
Hello!
It's gonna be great, guys.
So well.
No, it's gonna be great. It's gonna be great. I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm not gonna be an asshole. I'm great.
There are some things in this world that go way beyond human understanding. Things that cannot be explained. Things that most people don't want to know about. Sometimes shit happens. Someone has to deal with it. And who are you gonna call?
Beware, spoiler phobes. You're being haunted by a storm of spoilers. Busting makes me feel good. A podcast about the Ghostbusters franchise in ghostly association with the 2016 movie. This discussion can expand to include further information from any movies, cartoons, comics, Tobin Spirit Guide, Ghosts from Our Past, both literally and figuratively, and anything from Ray's occult books. Strap on those proton packs and check the containment grid. It's time to cross the street.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
We got work to do. Now, what do you need from me?
Hope you checked to see there wasn't a body in the back.
I don't really know.
You didn't check?
Let Holtzman check. She likes that type of stuff.
Yeah, I can think of 7 good uses of a cadaver today.
No, we got to turn in the body if there's one in there.
All right.
Don't do that.
Is this true?
Yes, it's true. This man has no dick.
Hello and welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers off-season tour. We are at Hook and Ladder number 8 in New York, or at least a Boston that looks a lot like New York, for Ghostbusters. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I'm here to tell you that the PKE meter is reading off the charts.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and if someone asks if you're a pod, you say yes.
And I'm Neil Miller, and this podcast is toast.
Boom. As you might be able to tell, there isn't a lot of textual use for Ghostbusters. This is a movie that has trying to become a franchise through Ghost Corpse. Ghost Corpse.
It's so core, it's like, but corpse is fun because it's like dead people and ghosts.
Exactly.
Ghost core, bro.
I did see your complaints that Neil and I pronounced J.K. Rowling's last name wrong several times last episode. Thank you so much for writing in.
Wait, is it Rowling or Rowling?
It's Rowling, like rolling with the homies.
We said Rowling several times.
It's but, got a W in it.
Yeah.
She's British, yo. Go with it. Roll with it.
We've been enjoying the feedback as we've been transitioning out of Game of Thrones and into new podcasts. So while we're still here in the pre-ghost-busting period, well, let's, first of all, I wanted to thank a particular reader that wrote in who happened to see Cursed Child and shared his thoughts. Dean, I'm going to read a little excerpt here because I think it was interesting to our Cursed
spoiler
Child.
Spoiler-free.
It's spoiler-free. Dean says, in terms of live action, the theater might just be where Harry Potter belongs. I realized whilst watching The Cursed Child that this experience was as close to what it felt like reading the books for the first time almost 20 years ago. And I think it was because I was able to see these characters that I know and love be portrayed in different bodies, but still be familiar. So we had a couple of readers who managed to see The Cursed Child and a lot of you that wrote in with your thoughts. We read them all, and I think I feel better about The Cursed Child, and I think I'm ready to talk to some other people when the book comes out. But thank you guys so much for writing in. Do we have any reviews that we got from Harry Potter Land, Joanne?
I've got two Harry Potter reviews I'll read. One is 5 stars, great crew, and it says, I came for the thrones and I will stay for the off-season tour. The Harry Potter app was great. Please read this with a Michigan accent, hard A's. I forgot to do that. I'm so sorry. Okay.
Wait, hold on. That is not Michigan.
Well, I was like, Adam Pally is Michigan,
that's
right?
That's Minnesota.
No, but Adam Pally's Michigan, right? Isn't he?
Michigan's more like a Chicago accent.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was trying to do. I failed miserably, but I was
sorry. I'm like, the Midwesterner in me is like, wait, hold on, wait a minute here.
And then this one is an accent-free review from JHam2088. Says, it only gets better with age. 5 stars. Such a refreshing podcast. Love all 3 hosts in the spoiler-filled Game of Thrones podcast. Really enjoyed their season 6 recaps week to week. The quirky intros are awesome. Love the content they are putting out for the off-season. Keep up the unique intros and continue spoiling for us listeners. Yeah, so I want to give Dave a lot of credit for his really inventive intro for the Harry Potter episodes. If you didn't listen to that, just go back and at least listen to that because it's amazing. No pressure to keep doing that every week, Dave, but
yeah, maybe there's another amazing one they just sat through. For all I know.
Maybe.
I'm batting 1,000.
I feel like at this point, people are just listening to hear what Dave's intro is going to be.
That's pretty good. It'll draw them in. But like, this is me giving back to you guys because you guys did so much Game of Thrones work and you guys are keeping track of the Game of Thrones news. I figure I could sort of buoy these other fictional worlds, especially when it's stuff that I really like. But wait, guys, we're almost talking about Ghostbusters. But Neil, we wanted to stop over and talk about Game of Thrones, and Joanna also has an additional topic that we got to share before we get there. Let's go with Neil. Game of Thrones, what's up?
Yeah, we got a couple Game of Thrones things, a few things happening out there in the Westeros. One, they announced the Blu-ray and DVD are coming out on November 16th. I imagine once that comes around, we will have plenty to talk about. I was like digging through the episode commentaries to hear which producer is going to cry. And other information, of course. they locked in some new locations in Spain. There's not really much to report there, except for the fact that some of it looks very coastline-y. So, you know, there's one location in Spain that actually looks like it would be a perfect spot to put, like, a Storm's End. So one of the big questions left with after season 6 is, where is Daenerys going to land? Is she going to go straight to King's Landing? This could be a potential answer, but we'll see when they start shooting if that happens. The other two things. One, realized today when I saw the trailer that the Hound is in XXX3. and he plays a character named Tennyson Torch, which I thought is almost a perfect Game of Thrones name. And then there was the not-so-big news that Thrones isn't coming back till summer of 2017. So that just prolongs our off season, essentially.
Yeah, that's why we're on a boat. We're going to be on this boat for a while.
Right. We're going to get scurvy.
Celebrate some holidays in the galley. Very sad and Thanksgiving, probably.
And as Joanna tweeted, it's going to be very sweaty podcasting about Game of Thrones next year.
The other location news that I believe came from the original HBO release, that they officially confirmed 7 episodes for next season, and that they officially confirmed that it will debut in the summer. But they also said that they would be shooting in Iceland next year, which I think they took a couple years off from shooting in Iceland. I think ever since John got back to the other side of the wall, they haven't shot in Iceland. So, you know, they're going for that wintry look. We might see some more White Walker stuff, but yeah, they're going back to the frosty.
We
frosty
might
north.
See some more White Walker stuff.
I dare I speculate that we will see a White Walker or two next season.
So, Joanna, you also have some Pratchett happenings. Pratchett-haps. Nope.
Pratchett-haps.
Pratchetting?
Have for it.
I don't know. So a lot of people ask me for book recommendations. A lot of Game of Thrones book reader fans ask me for what they should read. I don't think fantasy author Terry Pratchett is a direct match for Game of Thrones in any way. He's much more lighthearted. But there are dragons and zombies and stuff in his world. The Discworld series, what he's famous for. He died last year, I believe, last March. I think I was on a plane to Austin when he died, and I cried mid-flight. He means a lot to me. He's a fantastic author. I love his Discworld series. But I'm talking about it today specifically because his daughter, Rihanna, announced that she would be working with the Henson Company on an adaptation of We Free Men, which is one of Terry Pratchett's, it's technically young adult, but it's very entertaining to read if you're a not so young adult like me. So that is in the works. Who knows if it'll actually come to fruition? There have been some not great TV movies made out of some of the Discworld films. People, your mileage may vary on how great they are. I don't think they're great. I'd like to see more of a budget behind Terry Pratchett's world. He's so funny and so inventive. So I would really suggest reading the Discworld books, or the Tiffany Aching books, which is what We Free Men is technically a Tiffany Aching book. And I don't always do this, but I would recommend maybe even listening to the audio over reading it with your eyeballs, because the narrator, Stephen Briggs, does the best accents you've ever heard, way better than Joanna's accents. So.
Oh, I got to hear this guy now.
Yeah.
The gauntlet has been laid down.
Crimmins. So, yeah. So, listen to Stephen Briggs, read We Free Men. That's your summer reading, guys. It'll be really fun. Do it. So.
Fantastic.
I think I'm going to do it.
Yeah. I've been meaning to actually get into Discworld. I briefly skipped through it earlier in my life, but never like committed to trying to go through the whole thing.
We Free Men is maybe like the most crowd pleasing, accessible one. The Knack Mac Feagles, who are basically the brownies from Willow, but like more Scottish and blue, are really entertaining creations. But I think his best book is one called Night Watch, which is a Discworld thing, and it's the most sort of mature of the Discworld book. So if you want to start with something that's a little less silly, you might go with Nightwatch. And the last recommendation I'll make is that my favorite book of all time is Good Omens by both Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. So, you know, these are all summer reading options, friends. And they're making a TV series out of Good Omens. So all of this is to make you as smug of a book reader as possible when all these filmed things come to fruition.
Nice. Yeah, no, when was the first time I did that to be smug? I read Congo before Congo came out.
Nice. I read Jurassic Ooh. Park. Jurassic Park was my first experience as a smug book reader, I think.
I don't think I was smug for Jurassic Park, but I did read it. The first time I was ever really smug was Sphere, another Michael Crichton. Yeah.
Yes.
Because that movie was dog shit.
You guys, we're gonna have
Crichton children. That makes so much sense.
It does. We're gonna have to do a Crichton cast, guys.
Well, our real topic this week is Ghostbusters. I'm not exactly sure. There's a lot of facets to Ghostbusters this week. There's obviously the Paul Feig 2016 movie with the four female leads. There's a whole bunch of controversy around that. There's the original Ghostbusters. There's, you know, it's been out for a week, and so already we know that there's going to be more Ghostbusters in this world. Amy Pascal, I think, said that this franchise could be endless at the premiere when this 2016 movie premiered. There's a lot to cover, but what I'm most interested in, and we're ultimately here to make me happy, is what Neil thought of the movie.
The new one?
The new one, yeah.
I liked it. I thought it was fun. I thought it was a little, it's not perfect. It's brisk, and some of the story is feels a little rushed, I guess. But the characters are great, really well constructed. Kate McKinnon just kills it. Leslie Jones is fantastic. And a lot of folks had problems with like the CGI barrage at the end, but I thought it was cool. It really did remind me of the real Ghostbusters, the cartoon, and just this colorful world where the ghosts are more than, I guess with modern technology, they had the opportunity to make these ghosts each have a personality. Whereas some of the ghosts in the original movies, the original two movies, tend to look very samey, even though they're not the same. So, and they got the opportunity to do a lot more, which I thought was great. Yeah. So I thought it was great. Chris Hemsworth was the surprise, I guess. I expected Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones and Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig to be very good, but I did not expect... That's always the thing about Paul Feig's movies, is you watch... And you're like, oh, Jason Statham is in Spy. He plays another spy. And then there's all these layers to that character that you didn't expect. Like, Statham, you didn't expect him to be, like, crazy.
Statham is my favorite part of Spy. And right. I love Spy. Yeah. Well, no, maybe Rose Byrne. It's a toss-up, but yeah.
But there's always at least that one character that is way more than you get from the trailers. So I liked it. Everyone I went with liked it. The row of like seven girls in front of me really liked it. Like they,
isn't that great?
It's so and it's funny, you know, you sit there and you watch it, and I'm a child of Ghostbusters, I guess. It was like my thing when I was a little kid, Ghostbusters and Ninja Turtles. And you realize that this movie isn't made to please me, like specifically, like it's not for me. And that's totally okay, because it is for someone, and it for the people that it's for, it's really great. And those people are kids. Like, it's more of a kids movie than the original. And I think that's great. I think that that is exactly what Ghostbusters should be. Because if I want a little slightly more adult Bill Murray being a creep Ghostbusters, I can just go watch the old one and it's still there. So I hope that they make more. And I think that those characters, if given a little room to breathe, will be even better the next time around.
Yeah, I like the idea of hanging around with these four women, and I like the way that this movie emphasizes the connection between those four, and at least attempts to put it at the center of its movie. Whether it succeeds at it or not, you know, your mileage may vary on how good you are at inferring friendships based on like humorous interactions, but when you see like the original trio, they really only click, and they only click as a trio in the first movie, I think. And then whenever Ray and Egon and Peter and Winston all come back, they never really have a dynamic outside of I guess like really stock things. I always feel like they're in the cartoons and in the comic books, it occasionally feels like the characters are just, you know, on a tract to, like, Ray's super enthusiastic, and Egon has the facts, and Venkman has the wisecrack, and Winston's there, and it's so
Winston's
nice.
Kind of the cynic.
Yeah, exactly. So it's nice to see it was really nice to see a Ghostbusters team that I wanted to see hang out and be a team. I wanted to see the previous team do science more. This one, I feel like, hit the balance between hanging out and science-y.
I did... Go ahead, Joanna.
No, she can't talk yet. She's a girl.
What?
Am I in an ovary having timeout right now?
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to disagree with you a little bit about Ghostbusters 2. I think there's plenty of opportunity. Like, you know, they're a fractured team, but there are opportunities for them to work as a team, especially when there's this weird scene in Ghostbusters 2. Maybe this is off on a tangent, but, you know, where they're trying to jackhammer through the street and they have to pretend to be like construction workers. Mm-hmm. And Dan Aykroyd does this like long bit of improv that like Ray from the first movie never would have done. But he's like, yeah, all of a sudden I'm a guy who can play a guy who's just a guy. I'm just doing this thing. It's a thing. And then Egon's terrible at it. Anyway, point being, I love Ghostbusters 2. If I haven't mentioned it on like five podcasts this week, I have. All right, go ahead.
I think one of my only problems with the new one is that it felt like it was a movie that would have been a little bit, it still would have made sense and been a little bit better if it were a little longer, because I think they missed some of those character building beats, for instance. So like, you know, in the original Ghostbusters, they go from leaving the university to getting Hook and Ladder number 8, and there's that little scene in the middle where like Ray, or where Venkman clearly convinces Egon to mortgage, or convinces Ray to like mortgage his house.
Right. The franchising and, rights alone.
Right. And in the new movie, it's like they just kind of skip over stuff like that. And I thought that was the only missed opportunity to really further solidify that kind of kinship between those characters, or just kind of make it feel a little bit more authentic. Well, as a story. I think that's what I mean when I say a little rushed.
So I learned something today that I didn't know, and then I want Dave to sort of fill in the blanks for us where he can. But I agree with you. I think that's been a really fair criticism, you know, from even people who liked it, is that some of the characters feel a little blank, especially I would say Melissa McCarthy's character and Kristen Wiig's character feel a little interchangeable, a little not that much depth or backstory. Melissa McCarthy actually maybe the most of all.
Except for their feelings about Kevin.
except for the amazing title of their book. But one thing I learned today is that Melissa McCarthy apparently turned down the Leslie Jones role, that she was offered the Leslie Jones role, and she said no. She's played the sort of like brash, loud, you know, whatever character before, and didn't want to do that and want to do something different. And it's possible that when sort of transplanting, so I would expect that they would sort of shrink the Leslie Jones role down a little bit and expand the Abby role, because Melissa McCarthy is such a big star. And maybe in doing that, some of, you know, the backstory of that character got lost in translation. Also, Dave has some information, because Dave, you know, Neil and I are used to being the smug book readers. Dave has read 3 novelizations, was it, of this film, and so has some insight into what an earlier draft of the script might have looked like. Dave? Yeah.
Well, I mean, 2 of them were, to be fair, for people in 8th grade and below, but one of them was written by a horror novelist. But the reason I did that is, like, I've learned with movie novelizations, especially if they're released early, the, you know, licensed product isn't always, it's not like they saw a final cut of the movie, it's a novel, they had to figure something out. So if you cross-reference everything against itself, you could kind of get an idea of the screenplay they were working out of. And then I got to email a little bit with Andrew Schaefer, who is the author who wrote The Real Ghost from Our Past, both literally and figuratively. That's the book that Abby and Aaron write in the movie, about, you know, what he got to do, because for me that book has the whole Abby and Ari backstory and manages to sort of capture their voice more consistently than the actors do. And it turns out that while he was writing it, he did get the screenplay, but because I'm guessing because his book, some of his text actually shows up in the film, like when Kristen Wiig's flipping through Rowan's copy and whatnot, that's all technically from the book. But Kate Dippold and Paul Feig would look over his outline or read excerpts when they could, and you know, kind of thumbs up or thumbs down things. So I think he got the closest to, you know, what sort of characters they were supposed to be. But like, there's a whole bunch of stuff that, you know, like in that. I mean, it's little bits and pieces that are like left out. Like there's a lot more about the whole ghost girl backstory for Kristen Wiig's Erin. The ghost that haunted her like every day for a year was actually a repeating apparition that would raise over her bed and start puking blood onto her.
Oh, God.
And, like, that's very consistently even in like the children's novels. So I'm pretty sure they like cut that out just because they were like, let's pull back on, you know, being gross in this version of Ghostbusters. There was like a hanging out scene where they, you know, all successfully get Chinese food, but basically it's right after Patty joins the team and they're like, you know, if you're not a scientist but know a whole bunch about New York, we gotta like give you a primer on ghosts. And it ended up, you know, not being great because they do like a rap that they wrote in the, you know, college, and Patty sort of side-eyes them and ends up sort of being like a race joke, which they probably cut for that reason. But what we lost with that was a scene where you get to see Abby and Aaron as they interacted, because in college they were really close friends, and then they wrote this book, and then something happened to Aaron, and then one time when Abby was going to go on like the local college television station to promote the book, Aaron didn't show up, and basically they had, like, stopped talking.
But like, so like what happened to Aaron? Like, that's so weird that it's not in there, do you know?
Well, it's Abby's always been really forceful but has never seen a ghost, and Aaron has been haunted by a ghost but, you know, finds Abby, you know, as somebody that believes in her and doesn't treat her like a weirdo. So when Abby decides that she wants to promote this book that they've only made 2 copies of, Aaron's sort of like not into it, and it's the overenthusiasm that I think strains their friendship. But it's not really clear in any of the books what the big breaking point is, so I don't think that ever existed, or if it did, it wasn't important enough to that by the fact that it did exist by the beginning of the movie. But there's definitely stuff that I'm convinced was in the script that was them reconciling and spending more time telling us about who they were in college. But I think that kind of got cut out to keep all four characters on the level.
I would trade every single damn original Ghostbuster cameo, and certainly that Nate Cordry spray painting scene, to get that backstory in there.
That
do you
went
know?
On way too long.
That spray painting scene can go to hell. But like, you know, all the nods, all the slavish nods to the original, which none of the which landed for me, except as I said elsewhere, Annie Potts. Those really damaged the movie. Not damage is too hard a word, but I think that it dinged the movie, and especially to learn that maybe if they hadn't been there, there would have been room for more of this character building, relationship building stuff that we all feel was kind of missing. You know, that's too bad. It's too bad.
Yeah, but I'm also happy that it's there, because that's what makes me want to like hang out with these people again. So it's like Ghostbusters 2016 doesn't have to be a good movie for me, crazy Ghostbusters franchise fan. What I really wanted it to do was introduce a world full of rules that I found just as interesting as the Gozer universe, or whatever we want to call it, that all the previous stuff was set in. And this, you know, movie sort of does. And that's also what we lost by not letting Abby and Aaron geek out. Because, like, the raps about, like, the different ways to classify ghosts. And, you know, I saw a lot of people erroneously complaining on Twitter that the proton packs blow ghosts up in this one, which they don't. I've checked. They just push them like they're supposed to. But like the whole idea that you can blow ghosts up is valid, because the ghosts in this movie act differently than the ghosts previously, which were sort of like, you know, trapped spirits. These are energy that's manifesting itself with like that ectoplasm slime. So it's not like in the last one where, you know, the Scolari brothers die looking like the Scolari brothers, and then they come back looking like the Scolari brothers. So, like, we didn't have to have a whole Macy's Day Parade in the 1920s murdered to get balloons. We just had to have a spirit that wanted to manifest that way. So it made a little bit more sense to me.
But what's interesting about the Scolari brothers and, like, something like Slimer, right, is that it feels like the original movie was a little inconsistent, and that's fine, with what the ghosts look like. Do they look like they don't really look humanoid? I don't think the Scolari brothers look humanoid. They look like cartoon versions of the Scolari brothers. And like, what the heck is Slimer a ghost of? He's like a poltergeist, right? Or something like that. But in this, most of the ghosts, other than ghost balloons and that really tall one, are like quite humanoid, in their appearance. So that was interesting to me. I have no problem ghosts. With it, but
there's
like
a whole bunch of like background swirling phantoms that look a lot like, I don't know, green Crimson Peak ghosts during the Times Square scene. But yeah, a lot of there's slightly different rules with how ghosts manifest in this story world, which I appreciated. And because it was based in this book that you can read the entirety of by buying it on Amazon, and because the villain also read the book, I was kind of surprised that there wasn't more about that backstory, because it really seemed like it would have been an easy time to do it. I mean, but what we sacrificed in this Ghostbusters was, in order to have a team that's all sort of equally developed, we, you know, have to split the Dana Barrett role into multiple people, so that there isn't a single character that, you know, takes focus over the Ghostbusters. And I'm wondering if that's why we didn't get like any relationships, romantic or otherwise, that are sort of expanded upon in this movie.
If you want to be a smug book reader like Dave
for Ghostbusters,
you can go on Amazon and buy Ghosts from Our Past, both literally and figuratively, : The Study of the Paranormal by Aaron Gilbert. Hardcover $8.40, paperback $8.82, Kindle $9.99. None of these prices make sense, but anyway, they're there. It lists Aaron Gilbert and Abby Yates as authors, but really it's Andrew Schaefer, who Dave talked to. So yeah, I mean, that's crazy that they wrote a whole book. That's pretty great.
Yep. Well, then it's nice because it also was released about the same time as this Tobin Spirits Guide book, which was obviously like a phrase that I knew to say before I even knew what a guide or a spirit guide would be, just from like loving it from the first movie. But that one's sort of like a love letter to all the previous Ghostbusters canon because it makes references to all the cartoons and both the movies and the video game and the IDW comics. So there's a lot of good like Ghostbusters ancillary material if this movie excites you enough to want more something, which is, I mean, it's becoming my favorite part of fandom. Like back in the day, guys.
When we were all Crichton kids.
Yeah, there weren't any like franchise movies were like a thing that like you would get like a book adaptation, sure, but like a sequel would just be a remake of the original with like a few things added to maybe sell to some more people, but it wasn't like a franchise storytelling. These days, now that I know so many things are going to like start getting franchises, it becomes like the world building materials that become super interesting to me. So like
everything's an expanded universe.
Yeah, with like, you know, Cursed Child and Fantastic Beasts, I think Pottermore is really fascinating because you like have a living story Bible up there. And then with Ghostbusters, I feel like these books sort of show the outline of where everything's going to be. And then we could sort of plop other movies in the theoretical future, or at least not get excited about things that would be impossible. So I don't know. This Ghostbusters movie, I really like it in the sense that I saw it in IMAX 3D, and I kind of feel like it's, Neil was saying, it's for kids. I like that feeling. Whatever age you are, but it definitely takes plays with the aspect ratio and whatnot to kind of like thrill you. But I was mostly excited that on two points. One, there's a movie with four female leads, and it's not a big deal that there are four female leads in the movie. And two, I'm excited about the Ghostbusters franchise again. And after like 5 years of looking at Dan Aykroyd and being like, why are you lying to me that this is ever going to come back? I'm so happy that he surprised me for the first time that I could remember.
Can we do an exercise as a Storm Spoilers crew?
Is this going to involve physical activity?
Hell no. I was just wondering if everyone wanted to say rank the three Ghostbusters movies in their order of enjoyment.
Oh, sure.
I think I know
where yours is. I'm gonna go first though. I'm already steamrolling you by talking. So it's Ghostbusters 84, Ghostbusters 2016, Ghostbusters 2.
For me. And I'm your designation is okay. Anyway, yeah. For me, it's Ghostbusters 2, Ghostbusters 84, Ghostbusters 2016. Neil,
mine matches Dave's. It's Ghostbusters 84. The Ghostbusters Answer the Call and Ghostbusters 2.
Man, a bunch of Ghostbusters 2 haters.
Why don't I like Ghostbusters 2 so much? Ghostbusters 2.
Why do I like Ghostbusters 2 so much?
Yes.
I just do, man. I like, wow. You know, I think I came to it without a lot of the prejudice that, I mean, not that you guys are prejudiced, but I'll say this. If I were an adult now and I watched the original Ghostbusters and then like however many years later, was it 5 years later? Yeah. I watched Ghostbusters 2. Maybe I'd have some issues with it and I would see it as too over commercial and like all this sort of stuff when the first one had this kind of offbeat, grittier, if you want to call it grittier vibe. But having watched both of them like on VHS as a kid and not even really distinguishing them from each other, I loved Ghostbusters 2 more as a kid. And then I rewatched them this weekend and I was like, yep, I still like Ghostbusters 2 more. I think the villain's better. I think the share of screen time and things to do is better. It's not like the Bill Murray show like the first one is. Like I think everyone else has more to do. And I love me some Jackie Wilson. And some pink slime. So I love the second one. And I'm not alone.
I mean, you're making it hard to argue with you because your argument is, but I love it. I mean, it's hard for me to see that this second movie is any less Venkman-centric than the first movie. Because it's all a you know, him trying to get back with Dana, despite the fact that there's a kid that isn't his there.
But while he's trying to get back with Dana, like, the other guys are doing all the research and doing, you know, like, going into the River of Slime and, like, doing all this stuff. Like, they have something to do versus, I feel like in the first one, when he's going after Dana, the other guys are just, like, not doing anything.
And in the
scenes that they all share together, Murray just steamrolls them because he's so funny and he gets all the best lines. And I feel like Egon gets to be funny in the second one, which he's like not in the first. And, you know, Ray has more of a personality and Winston is not just like egregiously underserved like he is in the first. He's like still marginalized, but he's not like almost an afterthought like he is in the first. It's better use of Rick Moranis, which is very important to me. And Peter McNichol is freaking great in every single second of that film. So
Peter McNichol might be the first actor I've ever seen do an accent that's not his, but I thought that was his real accent for many years after he did it.
For me, it was Cary Elwes. I thought he was British until I found out he wasn't.
That's another good one. I probably didn't know that one either.
But yeah, Peter McNichol is still the only actor, I would say, who has an accent that has no basis in reality and is still wholly convincing to me. Like when they ask him where he's from and he goes like, the Upper West Side. Like, he's just, they're like, we know your accent's bullshit, but it's so entertaining. And even the scene where he shows up as like a spectral nanny to steal Oscar is great. It's all great. There's no bad of Ghostbusters 2. And then the Statue of Liberty dances.
But there is a little bad.
Yeah. Or, you know, a river of bad.
The pink slime is great. I love the pink slime. I love that it's like, you know, has an effect on emotions. I think that's so compelling. I don't know.
I think the thing that I always sort of just never made sense to me was this idea that the Ghostbusters had basically been like blacklisted by the government after what was, and no one believes in ghosts anymore after the first season or the first movie's ending, which is this near cataclysm that was witnessed on like on live TV. And they to like 5 years later and everybody's like, nah, you guys are frauds. No big deal.
Nobody believing in ghosts is kind of hilarious. But I will say someone pointed this out to me over the weekend and I agree with it. It's like, maybe back then it was hard for us to believe that everyone would like try to sue the Ghostbusters. But now I don't find that too hard to believe. If like the Ghostbusters came and saved us from ghosts, I believe they would get the pantsuit off of them in the society that we live in, that they would not be considered heroes.
They do cause a lot of damage.
Yep. So.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the amount of fallout from Ghostbusters 1 that they do deal with in Ghostbusters 2 feels incongruous to the sort of franchise story that they're telling. So I always feel like in that second movie spends like an hour getting going before it's like a Ghostbusters movie. And that's what always sort of like bothered me about it.
And then all of a sudden they're just back. Like they're like, this is, and I think that really the problem is like the first like 45 minutes of that movie where it's like they're downtrodden to the point where like most of them got other jobs and their whole, everything's gone. And then all of a sudden one person, like the mayor, believes them again. And all of a sudden, like, everybody's just back in the firehouse and Annie Potts is answering the phone and it's like, wait, what?
Like, we've done redone our logo with the peace sign now because, you know, peace
overnight,
sign.
It's, everything's just back to normal. Like you guys were like,
okay, all right, I'll come back at you. In the first movie, Ray mortgages his house, but like they set up an entire office in the firehouse, like an entire office. Like there are filing cabinets for days and Annie Potts is just randomly there answering phones in the first movie, like overnight.
They didn't montage that?
No, they don't montage that. They montage after they move into the firehouse. They don't montage moving into the firehouse and like building. It's not like a couple scrappy guys around a card table in a fire. It's like a full blown office in there. Right?
Well,
why do they have so many files? Why do they need so many files? What are all those filing cabinets doing?
Maybe those
there?
Files were just there from the previous.
They had offices in Columbia University with shit in it.
They go into the firehouse and it's completely empty and derelict, right?
Right. Oh. But like they have shit from their. They get kicked out and remember all that stuff's being moved out and they're like, what the fuck?
Hmm.
Like presumably they have other shit that's moving.
Most of all, I'd like to see Annie Potts's interview scene.
I guess like the small business story keeps my interest at the beginning of the second act of the first movie, but I'm not sure that the Oscar conundrum keeps my attention the same way until Viggo starts getting weird for the second movie.
It's a baby in peril.
See, I push over babies. I don't really care.
That was the first time. If you want to talk about Ghostbuster 2 first, that was the first time that I realized that they hired twins to play children.
Oh, because the credits?
Yeah, the closing credits, there are two babies. And I was like, what? Why did they need two babies? And that's when I found out.
Next, you're going to tell me Full House has some sort of, oh, no.
Oh, no. yeah, but anyway, it's okay that we disagree on the goodness of Ghostbusters 2. That's what keeps life interesting, folks.
I don't think any of them are bad movies, though. Like, I think there are a lot of people that think Ghostbusters 2 is a bad movie, and having rewatched it like 3 hours ago, it's not bad. It's just it suffers from sequel stuff, and and there's some weird, I don't know, but like the ghosts are better in that movie. The action's better in the movie. Viggo's terrifying.
Viggo's so good.
That painting is so. When I visited Lucasfilm a couple years ago, they had that painting up in the hallway.
Oh,
like
nice.
The original one. It's creepy as hell.
I will say one huge problem with Ghostbusters 2. Are you ready for it?
Mm-hmm.
It's that
Statue of Liberty.
No, it's the Statue of Liberty is perfection. It's that stupid painting at the end where they're like all around the baby. That's a terrible painting. Awful.
And you're all in on the idea that like good vibes saves the day.
Yeah, it's about, I mean, I bought in hard as a kid. I bought in hard to New York as this like rough and tumble place. And like the fact that Viggo the Carpathian was trying to take advantage of those bad vibes to like make it an even worse place. And the Ghostbusters needed to find the heart of the city, which they found with a Jackie Wilson tune and a dancing Statue of Liberty. Why not? Why not?
I mean, it did work better than like the first two Spider-Man films, maybe.
No one did anything in front of a flag.
Yeah, that would have been
my only
obvious.
Question is how did they get the Statue of Liberty back to her spot?
They don't. At the end, she's like on the ground. Like if the Ghostbusters got sued after the first movie, they're gonna get super sued after the second movie.
No, there's the pan away shot.
Really? Okay, you just watched it 3 hours ago, so I'm not gonna like
where like the Statue of Liberty is like back on Liberty Island, and it's like, wait, how did she get back there? Did they spray her with more goo and
They must have re-gooed her. I got yelled at on the Slash Film cast for calling it goo, even though Peter McNichol calls it goo. So I'm going to call it slime so I don't get yelled at again.
Ectoplasm.
So Ghost Bros don't yell at me again for calling it goo.
Why am I covered in this goo?
why am I dripping this goo?
Man, he might be the best character.
I think he's the best character in both movies. And I rewatched Ally McBeal this weekend, some of it, just because my love for Peter McNichol was reignited. So.
I'm not kidding when I say that I did not know that he didn't have a weird accent pretty much until I saw Ally McBeal.
Doesn't he have an accent in Sophie's Choice? But like it's a less cartoonish version.
I didn't see Sophie's Choice until later.
that's a more normal childhood than I had. Oh, it's that guy from Sophie's Choice, you know, like kids watch. Okay.
So we're circling, I feel like, my question I asked you guys at the end of last week, which is what makes a Ghostbusters story now that we've seen a couple different iterations of it?
Can we each pick like one thing?
Well, I mean, you could list off a couple. I think it's a assemblage of things. Think if it was one thing, everybody'd be making Ghostbusters movies.
Okay, for me, it would be A, slime, B, gadgets, C, ghosts, ofs, and D, a quartet of people who get along and are funny. The end.
Interesting.
Let me think. So I think that every Ghostbusters movie has this kind of rise and fall effect where the Ghostbusters go through, like, no one believes them, something happens, and then people start believing them, and then something happens, and some government official gets in their way, and then something catastrophic happens. So all three of them have that kind of rhythm to them. So I think from a narrative standpoint, the Ghostbusters at the beginning are underdogs because they're the only ones that sort of believe. And then they are heroes, and then they have to become underdogs again before the big final battle. So I think that is one thing that makes a Ghostbusters movie. And I think that it's always anchored by one core friendship. So even though there's four, there's always the two that are the main story. So I think you had Venkman and Ray in the first one, whereas like Egon was just like the weird one off to the side making all the toys, and Winston was the guy who was just here to get paid, I guess. So I think that it's always anchored to like this, you know, this duo at the center, even though that it's a four thing. And then, yeah, like Jonah said, it's the gadgets. It's the car. The car is very much a part of Ghostbusters. And the constant catastrophic destruction of New York City, potentially, instead of like a world destruction thing. It's just like, oh, man, they're going to destroy Manhattan, which I think is in contrast to a lot of what we see today that people are starting to get tired of, which is this constant need to try and blow up the whole world in every blockbuster. I think the Ghostbusters franchise is always contained to this sort of civic pride thing of New York.
Which is a big problem in the new one, I think, because they didn't shoot it in New York, and it's pretty clear. It just doesn't feel like a New York movie.
And they ate Papa John's and shit.
I mean, Ivan Reitman in some interviews has been saying that, you know, they've been thinking about taking the Ghostbusters out of New York to maybe, you know, do some other ghost mythologies throughout the world. There's definitely a time in the IDW comic book where they go on like a road trip of America to help bust some ghosts. I'm not sure if it works as well, but I do think whatever it is, having a sense of place in your movie is part of the Ghostbusters franchise for sure.
Okay, yeah, I want to revise my list to say ghosts, goo, gadgets, gang, New York. Five things.
Okay. That's a lot of G's.
Intentionally. I couldn't think of a G word for New York. Grid city.
Grid city.
Grid
plan.
City. Plan. All right. Dave, what makes a Ghostbusters movie?
I definitely think the techno babble, the fake techno babble. I think that's going to be something that's been part of it for a while. I want to say underdog, but I'm not sure if that's going to consistently be part of a Ghostbusters story or if it necessarily has to. So for stuff like the cartoons or like the video game, like the Ghostbusters are an established entity that, you know, some people believe and some people don't. And like there are certain things in both the cartoons and in the video game that I would say are still ring true as being Ghostbustery. So I'm not necessarily sure if they need to be underdogs as much as they need to be the ones who see the mystery where everybody else is sort of complacent with they're just being irritated. So everyone's like scared or there's property damage or there's something and the Ghostbusters spend the whole story being like, no, it's really this. And then finally it turns out it is that and they shoot it and they contain it. But I also think that Ghostbusters movie, by their natures, they can't end like the idea of they can't end the threat because it's always containment. So it's sort of like there's always an ellipsis. I would almost say like there's a lot of things that connect it if you want it to be a franchise. And instead, the weird thing is that all three movies came with such big gaps in between them. They all sort of function as like movies of their time. But if you're going to talk about it as something that always could possibly roll forward, then the idea of containment versus destruction, I feel, is key to the Ghostbusters. So it's like the EPA being the bad guy, or the mayor having some sort of control, is always ends up being the actual threat, because the supernatural threat, it's just like, let these guys or girls deal with it. So, I mean, that's really complex, but I think if I were to echo it onward, I think you could have more or less than four people. I think you could almost do like a straight X-Files. Goo probably needs to be there. And then, but yeah, jump it's suits. Really weird. Well, I'm sorry?
Jumpsuits?
Maybe, yeah. Jumpsuits. The idea that this is like a business or a franchise and it's not like a public service, I think also feeds into that to a certain extent. But yeah, and then somebody always gets covered in a substance that isn't the ghost produced substance necessarily. So you got like marshmallow. What is it? This one is, there's like a huge ghost balloon smothering.
Ghost balloon.
But yeah, something. Someone gets covered in stuff.
The jumpsuit thing bugs me because. It's another instance where I think they just sweated so hard to get the old school look on them, you know, where Leslie Jones is like, we should really have things covering us so we don't get slimed. Hey guys, I brought us these things because I work at the MTA. So it's fine. It's great. Versus in the first one, I don't know. They just had them because their ethos, Jeff Cannata brought this up on the Slash Film cast, and I had thought about this, but that they were like basically garbage men or exterminators. Like that was sort of their vibe in the original movies, that never occurred to me, but of course it's true. But in this, they don't seem that way at all. They just seem like scientists. And so it's just doesn't it feel like they worked really hard to get those jumpsuits when those jumpsuits, I don't know, they could have just worn them and not.
They
tried
did,
so hard.
I actually, when that scene came on, I was like, oh, that's clever. That's like a way to explain why, because they never explained it in the original movie. And in the new one, it's like, oh, yeah, well, like, why would they have jumpsuits on if they're just scientists walking around? And it makes sense that she would grab those very MTA looking jumpsuits.
Maybe I just have a bad attitude. Well.
I like this movie's way of explaining it instead of them immediately going hard into advertising, which is how the first movie takes it. You know, we're ready to believe you and a free balloon for the kids. You know, like that part's all gone. Now they're like, take us seriously. So I see why they would
love those
old
commercials, though.
Well,
especially,
I'm sure we're going to get them. We just couldn't do them this time.
Especially in Ghostbusters 2 when like Andy Potts and Rick Moranis are in the commercial.
Oh my God.
Who are you going to call?
See, it's so good. You love it.
Andy Potts acting as Janine, acting as an actor, is it's just gold.
So did anybody else get a like weird chill when you realize that the final form of the Destructor in Ghostbusters 2016 is a childhood mascot that we thought could never hurt us, much like Stay Puft Marshmallow Man would have been to Ray Stantz.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but even more so, I enjoyed the symbolism of like the original franchise being the monster chasing this movie. You know,
it's weird because like between Rowan electrocutes himself and Rowan becomes giant version of the Ghostbusters logo, I basically don't like any of the plot in between here and there. But then once he becomes giant version of the Ghostbusters logo, the movie seems to like find its subtext again, and you know, they all shoot him in the dick.
You didn't like evil Chris Pratt?
Hemsworth.
Chris Hemsworth?
Oh, sorry, Chris Hemsworth.
Evil Chris Pratt, though, that's a
Freudian.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Maybe wait for next year. But the evil Chris Hemsworth. No, I mean, I liked his credit dance sequence, and I'm glad it wasn't in the movie. But no, they didn't give him anything to do outside of like his one little floating thing, like Peter Pan monologue in the lobby, which was fine, but it could have. I think Hemsworth's best stuff is when he's being Kevin and not when he's being Rowan, for sure. But then I also like the idea that just design wise they took Rowan's ghost from like the mist to like the 2D character to like the giant 3D burlap textured ghost, and then into the portal at the end. As a fan of the polygons, as some of you might know, I was psyched to see all that go in like IMAX 3D. But it also, boy, when I was young and watched Ghostbusters, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man was the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, and I didn't know he wasn't a real thing.
Right.
Because I just assumed I didn't have a brand of marshmallows that was somewhere else on the East Coast, because that happens a lot. This one really resonated to me, what an interesting choice it is to choose a branding thing, an American brand, as the final destructor for something. So I appreciate it, both how they use it in this movie to comment on it, and I appreciate the original Dan Aykroyd idea much more. It just seems so smart. And then they picked the Marshmallow Man, and Gozer's stuck in it. So every time Gozer comes back, he has to be the Marshmallow Man. So there's this whole story where a subdominion of Gozer comes back and tries to make Ray choose again, but he chooses the Marshmallow Man again, and Gozer's just pissed because he's like, oh, the marshmallow isn't threatening. It's great. I'm so looking forward to those characters coming into our new Ghostbusters universe.
You're in so deep. It's so great. Okay, here's my question.
Yeah.
In Ghostbusters 2, 2018, are we going to have male Ghostbusters in the mix? Do you think? Because there was this talk, right, of doing a Jonah Hill, Channing Tatum type of Ghostbusters.
We know more about that
now. What do we know? What do we know?
So Ivan Reitman has gone on record, I think, with HitFix. Sony hired somebody else. They got 15 pages into the script and stopped them. And Ivan Reitman and Ghost Corps Prime never signed off on that male Ghostbusters thing. So that's dead. Ghostbusters 2 is totally going to be the women. Whether it's going to involve any male Ghostbusters or connect to the old Ghostbusters universe, I think, are the new fun questions. Because, like, you guys saw the post-credit scene.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it can, like, I can, I think they can bring in Zool, but I don't think they can connect to the old Ghostbusters universe since the actors played other characters in the first movie, right? I mean, I guess they could. Who cares? But, like, it seems more likely to me that they would bring in new young actors to play the men. But I feel like if they did at this point, it'd be one thing not to make another Ghostbusters movie. That's admitting some kind of defeat. But adding men to a Ghostbusters 2 2018, that is going to be a whole other level.
I don't think it's the men, but I do think you build yourself the multidimensional escape hatch in the second movie before you need it. Like, I think bringing a Peter Venkman back that's not Bill Murray is a horrible idea. Especially into this world, because it brings up all these stupid questions about, like, why nobody knew about ghosts way back when. But I do think that you could do what they're doing with Dark Tower. Like, I'm going to make this is non-spoilery as I can for people, but you put the Hornet Veld or something in there, and you put a token that says this is the same Zool. It's a later Zool, and these things all exist together.
Here's a better analogy, maybe, is the J.J. Abrams Star Trek, right? Where you just have a different timeline. That's to get to your Dark Tower analogy in a way that people maybe can understand who haven't read the books, which is, like, it's the same characters, but the reboot with new actions makes sense because they alter the timeline, right?
Sure. And then there's also an idea that this is already just a minor parallel universe with stuff like Slimer showing up and Stay Puft showing up. So basically the idea that this Ghostbusters pushes in its story world that the other one didn't is all ghosts in the new Ghostbusters 2016 story are there. It's a durable but not impenetrable barrier between us and the other dimension. So Roland uses the ley lines to weaken the barrier at a point creates a portal. But it's much more like Stephen King. I'm going to do Dark Tower again. It's much more like Stephen King Toad Ash Space, where just everything bad is over there, but there might be something beyond there, or there might be other things in there that aren't us. So unlike the first Ghostbusters, where it was like, you know, who gives a shit? Hell, you know, there's just some crazy ghost coming back. You know, the Scolari brothers obviously were coming back for some sort of electrocution vengeance. This one, there's just a permeable barrier, and there's all this psychic shit on the other side that could come through. So that opens it up to be like, if Zool's always in that barrier, then we almost crossed into that barrier from the Prime Universe in 84, and Vigo probably crossed over that barrier into the Prime Universe in 91. So all the ghosts would be coming from the same place is what this movie could do. And I don't think that means that you ever have to go back to the original Ghostbusters. It just wraps it up in a neat little package. It so MCUs like, it.
It's like almost like a 2-lane highway or a 4-lane highway. So on one highway is the world of 2016. The other highway is the world of 1984. They're going in different directions, but the median is where the bad, where all the ghosts live.
Sure, and that makes it like, so like this, the Slimer that we saw here could be the Slimer from the other thing, because maybe the ghost barrier is what's in between these worlds. There's a whole like physics equation in Ghosts from Our Past, both literally and figuratively, that supposedly explains this, but I've not had time to fact check the physics. But yeah, there's like, it's a barrier thing.
That makes sense.
It's a smart story move, because then you could just multi-dimensional yourself out of it, J.J. Abrams, Star Trek-esque. But just like, if they do happen to face off against Zool and Gozer in part two, then it could be the same ones. They just are invading a new world.
And it's kind of like Fringe. Like, you guys watch Fringe, right?
Yeah.
Where you have these parallel worlds that are happening next to each other. And kind of in between this world of ghosts.
I think you mean it's like Sliders, where you have endless San Franciscos. No?
Okay. I mean, it could also be like Quantum Leap, I guess.
No, Quantum Leap's one dimension, just different times, right?
I have no idea.
Yes, it is. let me assure you, mix not your Quantum Leap and your Sliders. But yeah, I think Fringe is, you were right the first time, Fringe is the best example.
So that makes sense. I mean, I think it would be weird to try and peg those characters into this universe. But they could bring back the ghosts. Like, who cares? Who cares that it's an, you know, Zool? It could be a different Zool.
Well, I mean, wouldn't it be interesting to, in a movie, since the first Ghostbusters movie we saw basically didn't have a plot and we could follow it. You know, like, what if we don't have to focus on the Zool Keymaster Gozer plot, because we know how that goes. We just get to hang out while shit goes down.
Get montages. That's the one thing that I wanted this new movie to have more of.
Yeah. I did miss the ghost catching montage. Yeah. But we got gear testing montage, which we didn't get from the original, which I see the impetus to try something new there.
It wasn't a montage though. It was just like them in real time doing it.
I guess you're right.
I feel like I'm being too negative. Let me just say that you guys are great, and Ghostbusters was fine. And
well, we know that. So you probably didn't like it as much as the two of us, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what were your big takeaway problems from it?
Well, the thing that you guys, one of the things that you guys praised as sort of essential to the success of the movie, is the chemistry between the four leads, and I just didn't feel it at all. I felt like they were all sort of on a different wavelength from each other, and that they never really vibed as a central quartet. And so none of that, not none, most of that didn't work for me. A lot of the stuff around it worked for me.
Do you think a montage would have helped?
I like, you know, even Rocky had a montage, so I think it could have helped.
I do think that they, in the original movie, you could say that about the 1984 movie, where it's like it's not a cohesive team, except for the fact that they totally just yada, yada, yada that with that montage, where it's like, oh, this is them becoming a unit. Whereas like the new movie doesn't have, outside of that one thing, it doesn't have anything different.
Well, I mean, like, they what they could have done is just, like, the... Okay, so, like, the first movie, when they're all about to shoot Gozer the first time, they have, like, that lineup thing they all do. Like, make them hot. Yo! Blah, 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 blah. But, like, the new Ghostbusters team is like, oh, shit, the city's going to hell. Throw your shit on. Where's Aaron? We don't even know. We have to go now. And I'm like, right. Damn it. The only thing we get that's sort of, like, equivalent to that is Holtzman's slow motion kick-ass sequence.
Oh my gosh, that's great.
But it could have been a team thing.
It is more of a, like, the existence of these Ghostbusters in, like, a post-9/11 world where it's the jump right into action. Instead of, like, hamming it up a little bit like they did in the 80s.
And
right.
I think there's just a lot more emphasis on action. Like, that final action sequence, which I didn't really care for, necessarily. In the first two Ghostbusters, it seems like in the big final set pieces, they needed to use science in their brains to solve, you know. It wasn't about them, like, punching things. It was about them crossing the streams because they had to, or making the Statue of Liberty go, you know. Like, they had to deliver on the concept of the movie, like something that they laid down in the beginning of the movie. Whereas this is just like, keep punching, punch some more. Okay, jump into this abyss and I'll jump after you. Like, you know, well, I guess the payoff, yeah, was the nuclear weapon on top of the car. But like, I don't know, that whole punching sequence. I mean, I'm all for ladies punching. You know me. You know that is true. But
we know you're not a misogynist.
I hope so. But that didn't seem very Ghostbusters to me. Like, them, we asked, like, what is a Ghostbuster? A Ghostbuster should crack wise, shoot a ray gun, and, you know, do something kind of biggish at the end, but it shouldn't be a big, like, brawl in the street with different weapons. And that's just a different thing that they decided to do. But to me, it just didn't feel very Ghostbustery. I don't know, man. Yeah, and to me, I hear what you say about the first film, about, you know, the montage sort of yada yada is their camaraderie. But more than that, it felt to me like all the different actors were performing on a different wavelength.
Okay.
Leslie Jones, who we all agree is a lovely lady who does not deserve any of the crap that has been happening to her on Twitter, is at one energy level that's like her usual very like loud, like that's what she does, energy level. And then Kate McKinnon is off like playing improvisational jazz in the corner. And then Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy, in my viewing, struggled to make an impact at all. So just like none of them like really worked as a unit. Whereas it felt like when the three original Ghostbusters and Winston are together, that it's like perfect harmony of comedy stylings. So I don't know, like maybe I am a misogynist all along and this has been a long con.
You got us again. We would have gotten away with it if it weren't for those damn female Ghostbusters.
Just when we wanted Joanna to be go full social justice warrior, she pulls back. God,
I do think that there is something. There's something to the fact that, like, so growing up, when I saw Ghostbusters, that was really my first introduction to those actors. So I always, from then on, thought about, when I saw Bill Murray, I thought Venkman from Ghostbusters. I didn't think Bill Murray from Saturday Night Live. That was something I picked up later. Whereas seeing this Ghostbusters as adults who consume pop culture, we're very familiar with Leslie Jones, we're very familiar with Melissa McCarthy, etc., etc., you know. And so we knew going in, okay, I love the vibe of Holtzman because I know Kate McKinnon, like, it feels like she was just born to be that role. But it also does feel like in a lot of ways, like, Leslie Jones is playing Leslie Jones in this movie. And then the other two are just slightly subdued versions of characters they've played before. Where it's like Melissa McCarthy not wanting to play like the loud one is one thing, but she's also kind of played the smarter than everyone gives her credit for person before, like in Spy. So I think that there's baggage there going into this. Whereas with the original Ghostbusters, when I first saw those, there was no baggage. It was just, here are these guys. So that allowed them to feel like different characters. Whereas in this new one, I can see how you would, you know, you could get to that point where they're not, they don't vibe quite as well because they are they are those actors, you know?
Yeah. You already know them as, or we already know them as distinct comic performers of a certain type.
But,
and that's who they're going to be. But to some group of little kids.
But
yeah,
I mean,
I know what you're talking about.
Well, I actually don't know if there was overlap here, but like I've talked to so many guys who watched Ghostbusters as a kid and like it was so important to them. And I'm not saying that, like, I mean that seriously, it was important to them. But like, you know, Stripes did come out first, which is, you know, Bill Murray and Harold Ramis doing this other thing together with Ivan Reitman directing. And so, you know, those guys did have some, and that was a huge hit.
Sure. That was, for the adults at the time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Like that was it was R, wasn't it? Definitely. There's topless wrestling. It's R. You know, so Stripes is a thing. Meatballs is probably already a thing, right? Like, I don't know about, Caddyshack must have already been a thing.
Hold on. Let me look it up.
Never mind. I'll stop making specious claims about Bill Murray's career. But yeah.
No, hold on.
Not Groundhog Day.
Groundhog Day, it doesn't matter.
But anyway, no. I think that's a good point, well made. I keep thinking about Freaks and Geeks. Like I had a revelation recently, or a revelation while I was rewatching Ghostbusters 1, which is why the movie was so important to so many young men growing up, and it's because these are like geek heroes,
they get to date Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah, they get to bone Sigourney Weaver, and it's like one of the first, or an early example of that, right? Of geek heroes. I know Revenge of the Nerds is around this time and stuff like that, but these are geek heroes, wisecracking guys, who get to bone Sigourney Weaver. And I always think about, I have no context for this time because I was too young, but like, I always think about watching Freaks and Geeks and watching the kids from Freaks and Geeks, like, quote Bill Murray, I think in Stripes, maybe in Caddyshack too, and like how important Bill Murray as like this comedy hero who was also the cool guy was to young men of the 80s who were on the geekier side. I think that's all accurate and fair. And so I think that's great that that exists. And I think it's great that this new movie exists for young women who want to be scientists, who, you know, whatever it is they want to be. Or as Leslie Jones has been saying, young women who look like her, who have so few models of representation, in blockbusters. I think that's fabulous. Or Kay McKinnon, who is like so, her character is so clearly gay, even if they were too like, scared to studio'd. Go all the way there, like, you know, like these interesting things are there for young women to glom onto, and I think that's great, even if the film didn't work for me personally. It goes back to what Neil said, which is this movie isn't for him, but it's for someone, and that's great, right?
I would like to point out that you were right. Meatballs, Caddyshack, and Stripes were all late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. So that was accurate.
Well,
I can't always be wrong.
Do we have anything else to say?
Stuff like Scrooged and Quick Change.
Yes.
It came much later.
Yeah, and yeah. But that, I mean, like, I was obsessed with Bill Murray. I loved Quick Change. Scrooge is like one of my favorite Christmas movies ever. Yeah, Groundhog Day, good stuff. So, like, I didn't watch Stripes and Caddyshack, and I still haven't seen Meatballs, but I didn't watch Stripes or Caddyshack till I was like in my late 20s. And by then it was too late for me. I watched them. I was like, this isn't for me. This is for young men. That's fine.
Well, I think that was Ghostbusters, unless you feel like we left a ghostly stone unturned. No?
No.
All right.
No, I feel good.
Then let's take this moment and peek ahead to next week. We have a little bit. We're going to cross some streams.
It's like a mashup.
Yeah, we're going to have a mashup. Neil, why don't you give us a preview of next week's stop?
So for next week's stop, we are boarding a shuttle, and we are going to fly up to the USS Nerdaprise, which is currently being assembled outside of Earth. And we're going to talk about Star Trek Beyond, and also the new Star Trek TV show. Dave's going to find out all kinds of things. He can tell us about it, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to go through with Joanna what she learned from Comic-Con, which will probably overlap into our Game of Thrones news.
Maybe. I doubt they're going to reveal anything. They didn't reveal anything last year.
Yeah. But we'll talk about, because I think they're doing a Star Trek panel, TV show panel at Comic-Con, and we'll see the movie as best we can. And yeah, other fun stuff from Comic-Con from Joanna, who's the only one of us braving the heat of San
Diego. Usually by the time I get back from Comic-Con, Dave already knows about Comic-Con than I did, even though I was on the ground, because he is like the king of obsessively monitoring things from afar. So look for that sort of situation. But also, I was going to say something. Oh, this is dropping on Wednesday. Is that correct, Dave?
Yes. Yes.
That is, isn't this technically Wednesday, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek? The Nerdiversary? Let's fact check Joanna again. I think that's probably a good idea.
it's certainly coming around here. It's the 50th anniversary year. I haven't picked up on exactly what the day is because I'm still doing some research, watching lots of Star Trek episodes. We're like super lucky to have most of them streaming on Netflix for everybody's pleasure. But yeah, that's what I'll be watching for sure. I mean, okay, quick primer for what you should be looking for beyond Star Trek Beyond. Star Trek was like really big in my family. I'm probably a Next Generation kid. I've been rewatching a lot of Next Generation episodes, and I've been rewatching the animated series recently to try to figure out who could be a new Chekhov in Star Trek 4 for sure. Because I think they're the answer might be there.
Abrams said they're not recasting.
Oh, no. I'm talking about what character could be a helmsman.
Oh, what character? Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, for sure. But I know, Joanna, you're a Next Generation child, I believe.
Yes, I am. A huge Next Gen fan.
And Neil, did you watch last Star Trek?
I'm a TOS person.
Ooh, nice.
My mom watched TOS with her father. It was one of their main things. So I've kind of stuck with that. And I have actually never really seen much of the Next Generation or anything after that. So,
interesting.
Yeah. Guys, really quickly, stop writing your emails. I just looked it up. The 50th anniversary of Star Trek is September 8th. So I was deeply off. Let's all remember when I was right about Bill Murray. But yeah. So we got a TOS person and Neil. I didn't even know there was an animated series. So that makes me feel like a bad Trekkie. But yeah, I'm a Next Gen person, huge Next Gen person. And I like Deep Space Nine. Okay. That's about my and I loved the original series when I was a kid too.
Any of you guys watch Enterprise besides me?
I haven't seen a single episode of Voyager or Enterprise. Mm-mm. So.
All right. So when you guys hear the word Zindi War in Star Trek Beyond, that they're talking about Enterprise.
Oh.
Just know that going in, listeners. Enterprise is the only show that is in both timelines.
Interesting.
Thanks to timeline splitting. But of course, we will engage with all of that next week. Yeah, that's right. We're doing it. Until then, though, we would love if you tweet at us at StormSpoilers or email us at StormSpoilers@gmail.com with your Ghostbusters thoughts, as long as they are, constructive thoughts. You're allowed to not like it, but do it constructively. We would love to hear your thoughts, because we certainly gave you all of ours. Where can people find our work until we head off to the Nerdiprize? Let's start with Joanna.
You can boldly go over to Twitter and find me at Joe Wrote This, or you can read my stuff over on VanityFair.com. Or for this summer, I will be on both Fighting in the War Room and Little Gold Men doing my best Katie Rich impression, so you can hear me talk about things there.
And Mr. Miller?
You can find me on Twitter at Rejects. You can also find me at filmschoolrejects.com. That's the website I write at. I am also doing a Katie Ridge impression, but it involves losing a lot of midsection weight. So, ooh. You know,
you're birthing a baby?
No, she had the baby. I'm just getting rid of weight.
Okay. So. and I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, online at latino-review.com and geek.com. You could find all the podcasts I do at fightinginthewarroom.com, including a lot of ones that were previously mentioned. And, oh man, there's so many good Star Trek things to say. Let's end with the 213th rule of acquisition, which I don't remember right now.
Nice. There isn't a 213th rule of acquisition.
Yeah, Dave. Fake
I just
girl.
Looked it up. So there's a 211, and it's employees of the rungs of the ladder of success don't hesitate to step on them. And there's 214, never begin a business negotiation on an empty stomach.
Stay neutral in conflict so that you can sell supplies to both sides.
Is that 213?
Yeah, stay neutral in conflict so that you can sell supplies to both sides. I like that.